Case of the day, the United States versus Kraft. Mr. Stevens.
Thank you, Your Honor. Jeremy Kraft was charged with 10 counts of arson-related offenses. Two of those were dismissed in the course of the trial, and he was convicted of the remaining eight counts. Three of those counts, counts one, three, and eight, were not challenging because the evidence was clear that a jury could conclude that arsons had occurred, that Mr. Kraft had committed those arsons, and that the properties were actually being used in interstate commerce. The remaining counts, counts 4, 5, and 7, are arson counts, and we're challenging the issue of interstate commerce in those cases. There was certainly evidence that the jury could conclude that Mr. Kraft had burned those homes and that, in fact, an arson had been committed. We also are challenging counts 2 and 9, which is use of arson to intimidate people because of their race, national origin, the various other civil rights purposes.
Before you get started, let me just clarify. If he was sentenced to concurrent terms on the arson counts, right? Because I guess one of my questions is, if we were to reverse his convictions on 4, 5, and 6, would that affect his sentence, given that there were concurrent?
Well, if for no other reason, the fact that he would not have his $100 special assessment on those counts would be affected. So there is some effect.
Would it have any impact on the restitution?
I would argue, and it's not something that I've considered, and I would be glad if the court wants me to do further briefing on it. I would be glad to brief that further. But if those counts are reversed, then I would certainly argue that restitution is not an issue. It's not something that I've considered, and I'm not prepared to make a definitive statement on it before this panel. Neither side has raised or briefed that particular issue. Counts 4, 5, and 7, certainly in my view, fall squarely between the Supreme Court's holdings in United States versus Russell and United States versus Jones. United States versus Russell said that property being used for rental purposes is clearly being used in interstate commerce. Jones, on the other hand, said that property that is being used for personal residential purposes is clearly not being used in interstate commerce. And I note that the arson statute specifically requires that the property be used in interstate commerce or used in an activity affecting interstate commerce. So used is the operative word in those counts.
Well, one of these properties was owned by Hell's Angels when they were probably not on hogs on the high seas. Motorcycle club. Wouldn't that be obviously a qualifying for interstate commerce purposes?
Well, certainly the Hell's Angels Motorcycle Club is a large organization, and this property in particular was owned by the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club, which is a social organization. There certainly was no evidence presented to the jury that Hells Angels are engaged in any commercial activity, selling goods or services of any kind. If there are services, I doubt very seriously that they would admit them in a court of law. The government did well, in fact, to get a former lead writer, I think, of the local Hells Angel Motorcycle Club to testify on behalf of the government. That may be a first. But the Hells Angels...
In a non-confidential informant setting, probably is.
The Hells Angels are clearly a social organization. The property was used for club purposes. It was used for parties. It was used to collect dues. The dues were all used in the local chapter. The club would from time to time, when a Hells Angel member died in another part of the country or, in fact, another part of the world, send a representative to the funeral, and those expenses would be reimbursed. But that falls in same line of reasoning as the 11th Circuit found in Odom with regard to churches. Congress, in enacting this statute, specifically had originally considered making churches and schools a part of the arson statute, eventually did not make churches and schools inclusive in the statute. And I think there would have been some interstate commerce issues had they done so.
On the issue of Jones and Russell, haven't we addressed that in the Martin case?
Well, I don't think that Martin specifically addresses the issues in this case. And in any event, what the Supreme Court has said is that use is the qualifying issue. The three properties that we have in contention here, none of them were actually being used in interstate commerce. The Hells Angels, as I've said, is a social organization very, very similar to a church.
But how do you deal with...
That's the first time anybody's ever said that in a court.
This case was an unusual case, certainly.
But still, I don't see how you get around Martin, because we have two apartments. Let's just talk about counts 4 and 7. Both of them were vacant at the time, but you're not contesting that they were being prepared for rental and for tenants, right?
That's correct.
And in Martin, we held that the rental property, you know, you're right, use of an activity in interstate commerce, but it could be temporarily unoccupied, mm-hmm. which is the situation here, isn't it? So how do you get around Martin?
I don't believe that Martin does apply here, because Martin is property that had previously been used as rental property. Because it was undergoing renovations, the tenant had moved out, and the landlord was doing some renovations on the property before placing it back in the market. And what this court held was that temporarily taking rental property off the market doesn't take it out of the stream of use in interstate commerce, because once it was used as interstate commerce, then the presumption was that it would continue as interstate commerce unless it were permanently abandoned.
So your position would be it would have to be occupied first and then vacancy in order to qualify.
That's correct. And in count 7, for instance, Eric Forrest had purchased the property and was intending to put it into rental property. He had done renovations which were almost complete. He had requested a Section 8 inspection so that the property could be listed as a rental property under Section 8. But there was no lease. There was no tenant. He, in fact, had not even placed a single ad in order to actually place the property in the rental market. So he was not using, at that point, the property as rental property. So Martin doesn't apply because it had never been used by him as rental property.
But you are not disputing that it was his intention, and we have a lot of indicia to support his intent. In other words, it's not just a situation where he says, I think I want to rent this house. There were a lot of steps that he had taken, and it was pretty clear, wasn't it? It was rental property.
I certainly would concede he intended to use the property at some future point as rental property. It could be the very next day. Who knows? But that's not what the Supreme Court endorsed in Jones. Jones said... our decision in Russell stated that as the dispositive fact, petitioner was renting his apartment building to tenants at the time he attempted to destroy it by fire. It followed from that fact that Russell opinion concluded that the property was being used in an activity affecting commerce. It goes on to say the key word is used, not intending to be used. And I think that is the distinguishing point, because Russell clearly said that property being used as rental property is within the arson statute. But on the continuum between the Jones decision and the Russell decision, it's a very slippery slope, and it becomes very, very difficult to pinpoint a point where a property that's intended to be used becomes used, unless you draw a bright line that says when you rent the property or when you place the property on the market or when you put an ad in the paper, you are using the property as rental property. Everything else up to that point is preparatory to using it. And we need a fairly bright line, or the statute becomes so ambiguous that it becomes impossible to interpret. I discussed the Hell's Angels Clubhouse in Count 5, which I think Odom is my strongest argument on that case. Count 4 dealt with property that David Pulsifer came in and testified that his aunt had owned the property, had sold the property to, I think it was her cousin, and then Beneficial Finance had taken the property. So Beneficial owned the property at the time that he was there. He was fixing it up for his aunt. As a consequence, I think the same thing applies there. Unless there are other questions on the interstate commerce issue, I'd like to move on to the remaining issue, the issue of intimidation. Counts 2 and 9 charge intimidation by use of fire under 18 U.S.C. section 844H. And I think the language of the statute is important there, because it requires that a person intimidate or attempt to intimidate individuals in their housing rights for two. It requires two elements in the conjunctive. First, that the person fall into one of the protected categories, and second, that the person is or has been, and it goes through a laundry list of transactions that are protected by the statute, but basically amount to an exercise of the individual's housing rights. Count two is property that was owned by a man of Hispanic descent. He was a naturalized citizen, he was building the house, but never took occupancy, never intended to take occupancy, and the property was for his son. It's distinguishable, I think, from the White case, which the government and the court, I think, both relied on, because in that case, there was a builder, there was a contract to build a house, there was a contract to occupy the house. None of those things occurred here. He was the person who was building the house himself. And I'll rely on that argument as to count two. Count nine is another situation entirely. Count nine involves an individual, Sam Triplett, an African American, who was in the house. All of the evidence is that he and Jeremy Kraft were friends. Certainly there was plenty of evidence in the record that the jury could conclude that Jeremy Kraft was very much of a racist. He used a number of racial epithets and comments. The evidence clearly
was... Plus he made reference to race when he was talking about why he burned the buildings.
Well, I think the operative fact in count nine is the issue of intimidation. The dictionary definition of intimidation is to attempt to compel or deter somebody. And in this case, he went over, helped Sam move out, Sam was supposed to pay him. There was no confrontation, no attempt to intimidate while Sam was moving out. Sam Triplett left the keys in the house. The landlord picked up the keys, so he clearly had vacated and abandoned the house. He was out of the house. Later the house was burned. Intimidate is to compel or deter someone by use or threat of use of force. And there simply is no evidence in this case that Jeremy Kraft attempted to intimidate Sam Triplett, who was already out of the house, who had already vacated the house. There was no indication that they had had any words or any confrontation during the course of the move. So count nine fails because, in fact, there was no intimidation or attempt to intimidate. If there are no other questions, I think my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens.
Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt.
The statute involved in the arsons that involved race and ethnic origin issues is actually broader than what Mr. Stevens just articulated. It talks about the use of force or threat of force to injure, intimidate, or interfere or attempt to do so with someone on account of race or ethnic origin. Here, the defendants told us why he set fires not to any old building, but to the homes of the Hispanic family and to Sam Triplett, an African-American man living in the neighborhood. He told us that he set the fires because the neighborhood was full of wetbacks and niggers. The defendant takes the position in his appellate brief that there was no evidence of racial animosity or hatred. That in and of itself was clear evidence of racial animosity. Webster says that the use of the word nigger is one of perhaps the most offensive and inflammatory racial slur in the English language, and is it a word expressive of racial hatred and bigotry. And wetback is similar. It is the term of derision referring to persons of Mexican or Hispanic ethnicity. And Mr. Kraft used those terms over and over again in describing why he did this. It's important to remember that he set fires to these homes. On the point of did the Ortiz family occupy this particular...
Before you go on to that point, what are the neighborhood demographics there? In other words, do you know the percentage of African Americans, Mexicans, and non-groups of color in that neighborhood?
There was no evidence of exact demographics, Your Honor. However, the evidence was that there was a mix of Hispanic, African-American, and Caucasian. Mr. Kraft was a Caucasian man, Mr. Triplett an African-American man, and Mr. Ortiz, who is a carpenter by trade, was building this home. And there was testimony, it was one of the nicest homes in the neighborhood. He was building this home for his son and his son's family, also of Mexican heritage, to move into. The home, the occupying requirement was fulfilled in a couple of ways. First, Mr. Ortiz himself occupied the home as he was building it. He kept his property in there. His personal property was damaged as a result of the arson. He kept his tools in there, lost a Bobcat loader, his truck in the garage, etc. But also the court cases say that even someone intending to move in, that's sufficient. Here there was clear evidence of racial animosity with respect to the Ortizes. He said he didn't say he cooked or burned the Ortiz home or because they were Chicago Bears fans. He says he cooked the Mexicans' homes. So there is both clear evidence of racial animosity and clearly the Ortiz family was occupying the home at the time of the arson. With respect to Mr. Triplett, again, the statute is broader than the defendant would have it in his appellate brief. The statute says that he was renting or occupying or has been. And the evidence was that Mr. Triplett had just moved out that very day when Mr. Kraft, the defendant here, set fire to the home. And when asked why he set fire, again, the neighborhood was full of wetbacks and niggers. And asked specifically about the relationship of Sam to the fire, he said the following, "Fuck Sam, Sam's a nigger." The evidence was clear of the racial animosity and racial motivation. And again, it doesn't have to be the sole motivation. It just has to be a motivation. And here it was clear. With respect to the interstate commerce claims of the defendant, and I agree with Your Honor, those were concurrent sentences. Mr. Kraft's time would be unaffected. His imprisonment time would be unaffected if the counts were reversed on those. Counts 2 and 9, with the racial connection, those carry their own mandatory minimum of 10 and 20 years. That would substantially impact the sentence here. But the interstate commerce claims, because the defense is not disputing all of the arsons of interstate properties, his time would be unaffected.
What about restitution?
Would also be affected, I believe. The restitution would be reduced, and those homeowners would be out of the restitution order that was imposed in this case for every home that was subject to it. But even accepting that, I believe that the defense's arguments are not meritorious. Mr. Pulsifer was living in 618 East Broadway. That's the Count 4 home. He testified clearly that the home was used as a rental to rent to tenants. He had been renting and living there. He had moved out a few weeks before the fire, but nothing had removed that property from the stream of rental commerce, if you will. And I agree, the Martin case is definitive here. There has to be a clear showing of evidence that the property was removed from that rental activity. And here there was no such thing. In fact, the evidence was that the home was being used for and was used for a rental property to tenants.
Hell's Angels, Mr. Schmidt. Who owns that?
Hell's Angels was owned by the Hell's Angels Motorcycle Club Incorporated, a California corporation. We were amazingly lucky to get the president of the Hell's Angels organization to testify at trial, and he testified clearly that the property was owned by the Hell's Angels Motorcycle Club Incorporated, a California corporation. He also testified as to what they did there. They didn't live there. It wasn't used as a residence. They used it to hold meetings, organizational meetings, fundraisers, to collect dues, right, and to hold parties, as you might expect.
So expand on the interstate aspect of it.
The Hell's Angels is an international and national organization. This group travels all over the United States and indeed the world. The specific testimony was this particular president traveled as far as Germany on behalf of the Hell's Angels organization.
And there was reference made, an analogy made to churches, which is very, very different than the Hell's Angels organization. But couldn't you have a scenario where a member of a church, say the pastor, does a lot of church-related unpaid missions work abroad, and therefore that the building is being used as an activity affecting interstate commerce? Would that be your position, that it would?
This particular building was far from a local church, Your Honor.
If you had the pastor of a church who did a lot of international work, let's say one of the goals of the church was, you know, to have international, to do missions abroad, and many of the churches do that.
Let me just add to that if I can. What if the pastor goes regularly to convocations of other pastors of the particular denomination? So we'll parallel it with this travel for the funerals. You wouldn't put the church's travel there in an interstate setting.
I would not argue that per se, because of that travel alone, the church was used in an activity affecting interstate commerce.
That's the thing here, isn't it, that they go to go into commerce to attend funeral services?
But it's only a part, Your Honor. Here we have a national organization, an out-of-state corporation, owning this particular property, and the Hell's Angels is probably one of the most interstate organizations and corporations known. It's widely known, and their activities span the entire country and the world.
That's true of certain church denominations, mm-hmm. right, that are located in, let's say, the South or the Midwest.
I don't believe that every church is off limits for use in an activity interstate commerce, but I think the holdings have been thus far that churches that are purely provincial or local in nature don't necessarily meet the terms. But here...
Yeah, but what about the churches that are not local in nature?
I believe, Your Honor, that arguably if the activity affecting interstate commerce was sufficient, you could make an argument, I think a very strong one, that churches were used in an activity affecting interstate commerce.
So then your position would be that if any entity, a church or like the Hells Angels, is an international organization, that the interstate commerce requirement is met. Is that, that the rule you'd like us to adopt?
No, Your Honor. Our focus was at trial and remains on appeal how this particular property was used. And it's not just who owns the property, although that was an out-of-state corporation and a national organization in that regard, but how was this particular property used? If it was used solely for purely local activity, then we wouldn't have a strong argument. But here, this particular property was used as part of the national and international activities of the Hells Angels organization.
Well, other than that, travel abroad, but wasn't this just the local chapter's meeting house?
Mm-hmm. The evidence was that money was raised for their national trips, including out of state, including to South Dakota, and other places in the United States. So this was specifically used. If you take a look at Exhibit 26 and you take a look at this property, you will see inherently it is a commercial property. This is not a residential property, not a local property. This was a residential type property that was used as a base of operations for a national organization, albeit the local chapter of that national organization. Finally, with respect to the property located at 1615 South Columbia, the subject of Count 7, this property was owned by a man who owned 20 investment properties. He testified he never intended to live here personally. It was always intended to be a rental property. He fixed it all up. The house was spotless, and he put it in the rental market. Mr. Stevens says if the home was rented or put into the market, then it would be enough. But this was put into the rental market. And how was it done? It was put into the rental market because he put it on the Section 8 housing list. And once it went on to the Section 8 housing list, it was part of the rental market. Why do we know that's a rental market? Because Section 8 housing assistance is only for rentals, not for purchasing of a home. So once it went on to that Section 8 list, we have a definitive crossing of the line, if you will. This wasn't just a preparation of a property for rental. This was, it was ready, it was put on the list, and it was burned while it was in the rental market. We believe that there was sufficient evidence. It's a fairly low threshold standard, both with respect to counts 2 and 9 on the issues of race and ethnic origin and on the interstate commerce issues. Thank you very much.
Stevens, I think your time had expired, but you may have another minute.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The government simply wants this court to say that the line between Russell and Jones falls not somewhere in the middle, but just to the left of Russell. The Supreme Court didn't say that. They said the qualification is most sensibly read, and they're talking about used in a commerce-affecting activity, to mean active employment for commercial purposes and not merely passive passing or past connection to commerce. The word use in legislation as in conversation ordinarily signifies active employment. We conclude that 844I is not soundly read to make virtually every arson in the country a federal offense. We hold that the provision covers only property currently used in commerce or an activity affecting commerce. The rental property that was a Section 8 property could not be rented until after it had passed the Section 8 test. So for those reasons, we think that all three of those counts. May I have just one moment?
Sure.
The court asked about the effect, Judge Williams, on the sentence because these are concurrent. In the sentencing guidelines calculations, these offenses were not grouped, and therefore levels were added for multiple count adjustments, so it would affect the guideline calculation if those three counts are reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. The case is taken under advisement.